Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Fell Into Food podcast, soon to be the number one food podcast in the world. That's right, I said it. And my guest today with me is Chef Adina Mullen. She, as I said, is a chef, a cookbook author, a TV cooking show host, and a culinary artist specializing in plant-based cuisine. Her journey into plant-based cooking started with her love for experimenting in the kitchen and grew through her travels, where she learned about different culinary traditions and flavors around the world. Experiencing diverse cuisines firsthand inspired her to create plant-based recipes that honor the culture essence of each dish while offering an alternative that is accessible to everyone. Through her cookbook, Vegan Flavors of the World Part 1, and we'll get into, there's more than one part coming, and her TV show Global Vegan Kitchen with Chef Adina on Eat This TV, she aims to inspire people to embrace plant-based cooking in a way that is inclusive, approachable, and globally inspired. So, Chef, thanks for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, and there's a really good reason. A lot of people hear vegan chef and they instantly shut down like, oh boy, here we go. But there's a good reason. There is a good reason. When you found out you were allergic to casein and eggs, so it makes it very easy to go that route. When did you first learn about your allergy?
I really started learning about it about 15 years ago, but I think I've been having issues like throughout my life. And I definitely noticed it more when I would be traveling because at home I wouldn't eat that much dairy, cheese. It would be something that I would indulge in, especially like in European countries, and I would feel really, really sick. And I was like, this is really interesting. What am I doing differently in my diet? And then as the years progressed, the allergies just kept getting worse to the point where I had to go see specialists and find out what was going on.
At what point in your career, you know, did you start to then kind of focus on, you know, going global on your cuisine? Most chefs kind of stick to one cuisine and they try and kind of master it. They may have experience, obviously, in multiples, but was there a moment where you said, you know what, I'm going to go and explore all these cultures and really embrace, you know, this plant-based innovation?
I think it like has always been an interest of mine. My parents, they are both hippies and are both American, but I think they wanted to be like Indian. So we used to go to like Bhajans all the time. I was really, from an early age, ate a lot of Indian food and just loved the culture. And so that was actually one of the first cuisines I taught myself how to make. And from there, I just realized how much I loved eating different types of foods. And a lot of times there would be things when I would go to a country, fall in love with that cuisine, and then not be able to get it when I came home. And I was like, you know what? I can do this. I will just figure out how to make it. And then from there, it just progressed. Every time I would go to a new country, I would become obsessed with their food. And I was like, you know, I personally don't want to have 86 cookbooks in my house and then try to remember where I found that recipe. And I personally was like, I don't think anybody's doing this. I think this is great where you can just like find everything in just one book. So that was really my approach.
Awesome. Yeah. And I want to dive right into the book. The cover art is absolutely gorgeous. What was the inspiration? Because I know that you did all the artwork in the book. So what was the inspiration behind, one, the cover page, and then each country and how you kind of took the country and then you plugged in the different artwork inside of it?
I just really love Goosebump Klimp. He's a artist. And my concept was like, I just kept looking at all these cookbook covers and it was like pictures of food or the person's face. And I kind of wanted it to make it like a cookbook, yes, but also like an art book, like where people could be like, I want to put this displayed on like my coffee table, like people do with like architectural books and stuff. And so I thought it would be a lot of fun to like switch it up and do that. And then for all my chapters, I thought to break up the chapters to put like an outline of their country and like incorporate like foods that were popular in that country. And so that's where that came from. And then when I was looking into like how I wanted to like put the layout for the book, I was like, oh, well, obviously there has to be photography in all of it. And then I was like, do I hire a photographer like to come to my house every single day to take photos mm-hmm. of everything I'm making? I was like, that doesn't seem very economical. And I was like, I can do this. So I just basically got a really good camera, figured out how to, you know, make the photos look really nice, how to plate them. And so it became a real passion of mine on, you know, taking videos of the food, photographing them, and then learning how to edit a book and just get it all into one spot and really learn how to do everything myself.
What's interesting with chefs and what I found, because I kind of went that route too. I've been, you know, in kitchens, but now I do a lot of media and social and videography. And I've seen a lot of chefs these days kind of shifting towards that. Some that I've gotten out of the kitchen and they're doing more of their own. They're just figuring it out or they're taking classes. I did the same thing with like video editing. I just said, why am I going to hire an editor? I'm going to learn how to do the basics and do it myself versus outsource everything. Mm-hmm. But back to the cover, why though the pepper? Like what was the final reason to go? And for those that are listening, we'll visualize this and I'll throw a picture of it up on the screen, but it's like the red and green pepper, like, but it's one pepper and it goes, I believe the left is red and the right is green, I think.
Yeah.
But why land on that? And then all the gems kind of throughout it.
Well, I wanted to make it look like kind of like it's an important piece. Like there's gems, things are growing in it. Like plants are special and they're not just like something you throw on the plate as an accessory. And I really was like, originally I wanted to do like a cartoon face of me holding like a piece of food, but I just didn't like how it was looking. And then I tried doing other types of food and different plates of stuff. And then just one day I was going through a magazine and I saw this photo, like a real photo, not like a cartoon photo, of a deconstructed pepper. And I was like, That's what I'm going to do for the cover of the book. And so then I just went in and redesigned it. And then I just thought like the color palettes of it were just like really nice.
Yeah, it's really cool. And it almost tells a story, right? Of how a pepper, you know, it goes from red and as it sits, it starts to change colors. And that's, you know, how the other peppers develop. I absolutely love it. It was the first thing I noticed. And I was like, wow, that's just stunning.
Thank you.
When you're making this cookbook, you know, how do you decide what recipes make the cut? Because you cover the U.S., Mexico, Brazil, Peru, Italy, France, Morocco, Ethiopia, China, Thailand, Turkey, Greece, and in all facets, apps, soups, salads, sides. So how do you narrow it down to what's going to actually make it into the book?
Yeah, so what I like to do when I'm writing my cookbooks, I'll like sit down for a couple days and come up with like kind of a breakdown of like what I want. And I knew that like a lot of books, they'll just have all desserts or just all soups or all salads. And I was like, well, people like variety. So I was like, I'm going to break it up and to make it like fair for all the countries, everyone will have 12 recipes. And so that's kind of how I did it. And I was like, okay, well, let's say you want to make a meal, have like dinner, and you're like, but I'm obviously not just going to have an entree and dessert. Like I'll probably have like 3 to 4 courses. So I made it where that is kind of what people can do. They can pick 1 or 3 for each one, or if they want to go crazy, they can make all 12 recipes and then be able to have like a full meal for their event.
Sure. Being global and vegan sounds really difficult, but many countries actually rely on that non-animal protein diet. You mentioned Indian earlier, you know, in your travels. And I know I'm in an area and I'm surrounded by a lot of Indian families and a lot of them talk about how they don't eat meat. What was your experience traveling all the different countries with those cultures and the non-animal proteins?
I definitely think some countries, it's definitely a little bit harder to not eat meat products. They're very like incorporated into the food, but other countries, I agree. It's definitely a lot easier because they're mostly vegetarian. And I found like with countries like that, especially like with India, you just have to replace like the dairy products that are in it. So like anything where it's like cream-based or cheese, I would replace it with like tofu or like plant-based dairy products. So that made it a lot easier. Now, when I moved into the desserts, that's when it became a little bit more challenging because a lot of the desserts are very milk-based or cheese-based. So that was a huge challenge. When I was, and India is actually going to be in volume 2. So I've already completed that. And so the desserts were some of my favorite, and I really wanted to keep them true to like their flavor profile and texture. And so that was a lot of fun and challenging all at the same time, especially like Ras Malai, which is a very staple, very popular dessert. That one took me quite many years to get like just right because the texture is like really important to the dessert.
So on the flip side, you know, which cuisine or region presented the hardest challenge because they do rely heavily on animal derived flavor notes, fish sauce, lard, specific cheeses. So which of those regions or cuisines was the hardest on that side?
I think France was really difficult because they just are putting butter in everything. And
Of course.
But I mean, that was an easy thing to switch out because there are so many plant-based butter alternatives now. So that was something that was really easy. And then anytime there was like a meat dish, I would just substitute it for something that was not meat related. So
yeah,
I felt like that was a little easier for me to do.
We say as chefs, fat is flavor. You know, it's in classic global cooking, you mentioned France, that's in everything. When you're developing the recipes and developing flavors, how is the mouthfeel with, I guess, a fake or synthetic butter versus the real thing? And how do you make that work in a recipe so it has the right mouthfeel?
I personally haven't eaten butter in like 20 years, so I can't really tell the difference. But I do notice that some people can taste the difference. And with that, I think there are certain products out there that definitely have the same texture and taste profile. So like, I know like Mykonos butter is one of those where a lot of people don't notice that there's a change in taste at all. And that one's made with cashews.
You write also too in your book, you have a section, literally it's veganize a non-vegan, and you go through a whole list of substitutions that you can make, you know, but how are you asking either, let's say more a traditional, you know, someone who omnivore eats everything, asking them to accept a new flavor profile based on the memory of the original ingredients, bone broth, aged cheeses that have specific textures, the mouthfeel, all that stuff. How do you translate and recreate that full sensory experience, the memory, when the traditional anchor ingredients are just swapped out of a recipe?
I don't try and swap out like all the ingredients, because like most of the time it's the sauce that really makes the recipe. And so like, it's just really the protein that I'm like taking and replacing. So with that, like I try and keep the core spices and then like the tradition of how it's cooked. And then I take whatever it is, let's say it's like some kind of like pork or something. I might use like an oyster mushroom, or if it's chicken, I might use tofu. And I try and cook it in the same kind of way that it was cooked before. So the texture and the flavor and like the memories and everything kind of like stay incorporated.
And you lead me right into getting your personal and professional thoughts on fake animal protein sector, right? There's so many things out there that mimic it. And you have two sides of what I see is a true vegan. Mm-hmm. It's going to be like, well, I don't want anything that mimics an animal because... Mm-hmm. Of everything, and I don't want it to remind me. And then you have others that might eat it. So what are your personal and professional thoughts on it?
I mean, I personally don't have a problem with like having mimicked meat every now and then. When I cook at home, I will use it sometimes. But my belief is that if I'm going to eat whole food, I try and eat whole food. And in the recipes, I will add some because I don't want people to feel like they can't use it at all. So I'd say maybe like 1 in 8 recipes, I'll use some kind of like alternative meat, plant-based products, because people are out there, it's easy to find, and they every now and then do want to use it. And some of the products are getting better. And so I do include them in there, but most of the recipes I'll try and keep whole-based. Like I'll try and use products like tofu, satin, TVP protein, which is something that a lot of people don't even know is a thing. And it's really, really high in protein. Like almost double what like chicken breast is. And the nice thing with that too is that it comes shelf steady. So it's you like when you make it, you just like rehydrate it with like water or vegetable broth or whatever you want, and then you just add it in, and it's like crumbly, so you could replace it for like, you know, ground beef or anything that, I mean, obviously not like a chicken breast, but if you're like, we're dicing up meat or something, it's a great substitute. I also really like to use like jackfruit and other things like that.
Yeah, some of those plants really do. You can mimic a meat and taste like a pulled pork. Mm-hmm. I've had some jackfruit taste just like pulled pork. You wouldn't even
Absolutely.
Tell.
Absolutely, yeah.
And those that don't know, TVP stands for textured vegetable protein. So if you ever need to find it, I'm sure it's out there. And again, you also have in your cookbook a whole section of where to go to where to look for these items, because some people say, oh, it's daunting and I'm trying to find mm-hmm. these things and I don't know where to go. You kind of give them a good starting point to say, here's where you need to go. And if it's a traditional store, look in these aisles, because that's probably mm-hmm. where it's hiding, not just in the specialty store.
Exactly, exactly. And I try and put things in my cookbook there where most of them I can find in my local grocery store. Some chapters, there are spices that are a little bit harder to find, but with the internet nowadays, you can find anything. Just go online and it's within like a 2-day shipping usually. So I've never had an issue finding any product that I've needed.
You've said food is your art, a reflection of your journey. You know, do you see cooking primarily as a form of expression, like painting, or a form of service, more like architecture? And how does that definition change when you're under pressure of a timed private event? Because you do a lot of private stuff as well.
I think it's a little bit of a blend, but if I had to pick one, I would say more of like an art, because I really try and make it something that's like it coming from me. And the recipes are just like ideas that fall out of my head from my experiences. I definitely know that when I am like in a time crunch, yeah, there is a okay, I have to make sure everything goes out at the right time and everything's warm or cold, or, you know, and everybody's happy and getting what they need. So there's a little bit, but I always try and do as much prep ahead of time so I don't feel as rushed. And usually, I mean, it depends also like on what kind of event, because some people are just like, you do you. We just want to sit here and talk to you and watch you cook. It's more sometimes about the experience than, and then they're like, and then we get to enjoy the food afterwards. So they don't care so much about a timeline. And some people are like, this is the schedule. You kind of get a feel for it too. I always try, if I say dinner's at 7, I try and make sure dinner's at 7. But that's just kind of how I am.
Schedules and private events, I mean, good luck. They'll always say 7 p.m. sharp. And then they're like, wait, we need to wait. We have two more guests coming. And the next thing you know, it's 8 o'clock and you're trying right. to figure out, how am I going to keep this, whatever you've pre-prepped, alive?
Right, exactly. That definitely happens a lot too.
When you're doing these events as well, you know, a lot if, now are, I guess the question should be, are a lot of the people you're cooking for, do they specialize in and they're wanting that type of food, that more plant-based, natural, or is it a blend of clients?
No, it's definitely a blend of clients. And some people, they're just like really excited to try something new. And some people are like, kind of got talked into it or whatever. They want something a little different. You never know. So it's always interesting to meet new people and find out what they want.
And you're focusing on local and fresh, probably seasonal, right? I think a lot of us mm-hmm. chefs try to do that as much as possible. What goes behind the logistics of buying specialized fresh ingredients, you know, especially all over the country, depending where you're at,
yeah,
you know, and then minimizing food waste, which, you know, is obviously something we take pride in, of trying to not throw anything away.
No, I'm definitely of the belief that I don't throw anything away. If like I made something and I made too much of it, I try and either alter it to make it into a new recipe. But I'm also kind of one of those people that I make less than maybe I need, because I personally am like, okay, sometimes I know I will eat this for 5 days, but a lot of times I want to eat something different every day. So I'll just make a little bit less, unless it's something that's like super easy to like convert into something else. Like maybe I'll make like 3 cups of plain rice. I won't add any seasoning to it, because it's really easy to just let it sit in the fridge and then you can take what you need and add to it later. But if I'm making a main dish, especially if it's something that I'm like, this isn't going to sit well for a couple days, I'll just make less.
Yeah, I love rice. Rice is such an easy one to do, to just cook it, mm-hmm. leave it, and it's better always, in my opinion, the next yeah. day than eating it right out of the rice cooker, or however Absolutely. You're doing it. And yeah. and it absorbs so much, and it's just a good filler if you need to get something
Absolutely. To fill the belly and the nice up. Thing is there's like 20 varieties. So if you don't want to eat like basmati rice every day, there's so many different kinds you can get.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. You know, serving both type of clients, do you ever try and sneak in some of the more plant-based stuff and see, are they willing to try those type of things?
Sometimes I just, when I create menus, I don't even tell them it's plant-based.
Really?
I'm just like, here you go. Yeah, like, especially with my desserts, I'm like, oh, we're having a tiramisu cheesecake tonight. And they're like, amazing. And then I just bring it and they don't even know.
I wish more people were more open-minded to just trying whatever it is that you come up with as a chef and that yeah. they trust here's what you want. And then you get those picky ones that are just like, I don't, it needs to be exactly this. But then when yeah. they try things, they don't even realize. Like, I know for steak, I love to use like lion's mane. Mushroom.
Oh, I love lion's mane. I actually did a barbecue. My dad came to visit and I was like, oh, we're going to do a barbecue. And he's like, amazing. He's like, I thought you were vegan. I'm like, I am. I was like, we can have a vegan barbecue. And I bring out these lion's mane steaks that I grilled. And he's sitting there eating and he's like, why did you give me steak? And I'm like, I didn't give you steak. That's mushroom. And he's like, I had no idea.
We did a lion's mane chicken nuggets. We have a mushroom farmer here in Chicago and he brought some over and he's like, hey, dude, we're going to make this. And I was like, what? And we just dipped them in egg wash. Now, obviously, you could sub that out. And then we coated them in breadcrumbs and then I just air fried them.
Amazing.
And you would not believe how much they tasted like a chicken nugget. And it blew my mind. And I think that's what people, when they hear plant-based, they instantly go to the fake things and, okay. and all that. And it's not about that. It's about using the things that are at our resources that mimic animal proteins or have that texture. I think it's more of a texture thing.
I think people associate food with memories. So when you're like, here's a burger, and it's not what they consider a burger, their like brain just like kind of like loses their mind or something. They're like, nope, this is not what I want. And they like get upset. But if you can show them that it's the same thing, just a little different, but maybe they don't even know it's different. Like, then I think it's fine. I think it's really just in people's minds, I think.
I want to go back to your travels around the world and all these countries you visited. What's the game plan? When you go land down in a country, is it just, you know, you're on a vacation, or is it a very specific plan of I'm going to this country and I want to learn about these things and that part of their cultural cuisine? How does that all work?
No, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I always try and make it a vacation, but then I also use it as research. So it's not like I'm like, oh, I'm going there to go to these 10 restaurants and meet these chefs and do this and that. Like, I like to explore like the region, see what I'm doing, drive around, do activities, talk to people, go to restaurants. Because, I mean, some of the recipes I've come up with have nothing to do with any of the restaurants I've eaten at. It might have been I was at a museum and I saw some artwork and I was like, oh, you know what this makes me think of? And then I come up with a recipe from there.
And I just realized, I didn't even ask you how you actually really fell into food. How did you even become a chef?
So I just kind of always loved it. I think I was like in my early 20s, I was dabbling. I was like, you know, I would love to go to culinary school. Originally, I wanted to make wedding cakes. And so I was like, this would be a lot of fun. So I interviewed at some culinary schools. And then I realized that it's basically like a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday kind of thing. And I was not prepared to quit my job. So I basically told the admin person, I was like, well, do you have like night classes? What kind of, you know, do you do anything else? And she's like, no, but why don't you just go to a couple restaurants you like, talk to the chefs, get an idea if this is something you want to do. So a couple days later, I actually went to dinner with a friend at this local French restaurant. And we're enjoying the meal. And I was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to ask if I can talk to the chef. And so I asked, talked to the chef. He came out and basically told him my story. And he was like, we only work nights. We only have dinner except for on the weekends. He's like, do you want to come and help us prep one day this week? And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. So I came in, helped him prep. And then he offered me the job as pastry chef there. And he was like, I'll train you with all the stuff you don't know how to do. So that's basically where it all started. And I was like, this is great. And he was like, you can keep your other job. Just give us like a day or two's notice if you can't come in. And I was like, Yeah, that works for me. And it was great. I worked there for a while. And then he ended up moving to a restaurant in Temecula and inviting me to go with him. But at the time, it was too far of a drive. So I ended up going and working at a gluten-free bakery for a while. And then from there, I was like, you know what? I think I really want to enjoy like learning how to just make everything. And that's also when like a lot of my allergies were coming about. And I was like, I'm going to take everything I learned and learn how to make it vegan.
That's interesting. There's a vegan or gluten-free pastry shop up here in Chicago. I'm sure there's a lot of them, but I think it's Westtown Bakery is the name of it, and it's got the whole right in the middle of it. It's a big glass dome. It's all like area, like everything. Like it's truly certified. Some of the best pastries I have ever had have came out of there. And you, if they told you how they're made, you would be like, no, I don't believe you. I don't believe you at all. So there is definitely ways to make things taste really, really good without gluten and without animal products.
I completely agree. I completely agree.
Now, when you worked in that rest, like how long were you in the restaurants before you then decided to kind of start doing some private stuff and what you're doing today?
I would say like about 9 months to a year for both. And then I just started doing it on the side, and I still kind of at the time wanted to make wedding cakes, so I was making them at my house. But then I was like, what do I do with this three-tier wedding cake? I can only eat so much cake, and I'm like trying to pawn it off to people, and they're like, yeah, I'll have a piece. And so I was like, okay, I'm gonna have to learn how to miniaturize these. So then I basically took the wedding cakes and made them into like individual sizes, and I was like, okay, this is easier. And then I did make a couple wedding cakes for some like friends, and I did some like specialty cakes just, you know, for friends and family and stuff. And I was like, this is actually a lot. Like, I need an extra refrigerator. I need a ton of like kitchen space, counter space. And if there's any kind of issues, like that you can't bow out, like you have to keep those 3 days before the event open. Like, there's nothing you can do. Like, and I was like, you know, this is fun every now and then. I don't think this is what I want to do. I think I want to just do like all types of food. Like making desserts, yes, I really enjoy it, but I want to make like entrees, appetizers, other things as well. So that's kind of where that started. And I was just making stuff and creating recipes around the house. And then COVID happened. And I was basically not working anymore. And so that's when I started Adina's Delicacies and was like, all right, I'm going to really like dive into this. And like basically every day, like I would just like come up with like a whole meal plan because what else was I going to do? And every dinner was like four courses. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to write a cookbook. And I'm like telling friends and family, they're like, yeah, sure. And I was like, and I'm going to have it done in 4 months. And they're like, no. And I did. It took another 2 months to edit it. But yeah, it was a little bit crazy. I was making like five recipes a day. So when I started book two, I was like, I'm going to give myself 7 months. I think 4 months was a little ambitious.
Writing a book, I've listened to Tim Ferriss when he talks about writing his book and what it takes, and more of a traditional, not a cookbook. And he said the mental strain that it can take on you trying to get everything exactly, even a cookbook is very like the font style and the size and the picture and the placement and where everything is. And then you've got the little prelude to yours, you know, and others have different things. That's just, it blows my mind. And I commend anyone that could take the time to write a cookbook because there's no way that I don't think I could sit down and do it. You know, I've always talked about like, oh, I'll write like the memoirs of all the crazy stuff that's happened throughout my career. And I think every chef has enough of those stories. But I'm like, do I have the patience to sit down and be able to put all of that on paper and then format it and have it where it needs to be and have it published? So did you self-publish or did you have a publisher?
I did. I self-published the first book,
Okay.
and the second book is technically done. I just need to finalize the cover art. The reason why I haven't published it yet is because I am looking for a publisher, and that's a very timely endeavor, which I'm learning. So I think I'm going to give myself about a year from start to finish. And if I don't find one in time, then I'll self-publish the second one. So the plan is to have the book out in the market sometime mid 2026.
Yeah. So all those of you foodies listening, if you've got a publisher, you wrote a book, reach out so we can make some contacts here, because that's what we do in the industry, is we connect people. I wanted to ask about the YouTube, right? So you started, or you did, I don't know if it was a promo or what and how was that shooting that?
It was interesting. It was a lot of fun because they reached out and they were like, we want you to come to New York and do this promo. And they were like, why don't you pick one of the chapters from your book and pick like three of the recipes? So I picked Brazil and I made three of the recipes. And basically I sent them the grocery list ahead of time. So when I showed up like an hour or so before we did the filming and basically measured everything out, and then everything's kind of behind the scenes, there's just like a million little ramekins everywhere. And then you make one, you have everything right in front of you. And the camera guy is amazing. He would always tell me like where to look and how to talk. And he's like, okay, now cut. Now go get what you need. And while I'm going to get what I need, there's this amazing woman standing like on the side and she just is doing all my dishes. And I was like, here is my home address.
That's paradise. When you get someone to do the dishes for you. And I mean, normally we're like, we'll help. But when there's somebody there to do it for you. Yeah.
It was amazing.
Take them up on it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was so great. So the taping was a lot of fun and it aired really well. And I mean, I would love to do it again. It's just about getting enough sponsors. So that
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, you should even, and it's something I've done, is I'll pick a recipe and I'll kind of create it and just self-publish, obviously, on YouTube. Because I think with your cuisine, people, I think, have a high inclination. They want to do more plant, that home cooking, but I think they're afraid. I think they're really afraid. And I think you have something special and unique that you could kind of show people, okay, here's, and even if it's kind of with the glasses or whatever, and you're like, all right, here's how we're going to do it. And it's you going into the grocery store and you find the ingredients. Like, look, this is how easy it is to find them. And you find all the ingredients and then you take them back to your house and you just put the dish together as if you would for a regular dinner night, to show people that it doesn't take anything crazy or special, or some of the techniques that you use. I think that's what a lot of people are afraid. They don't know how to make the swaps. You talk about the swaps, but you know, even I have to look it up. Okay, well, if I'm swapping eggs for an egg alternative, is it a one for one? Is it two for one? Do I need to let it sit? Does it have to cool down? Do I have to heat it up? Because some of those things take special instructions to use. I think you could do something really cool to the public, just to get them introduced to it more and take and bring your cookbook alive, like in a visual format. It'd be pretty cool.
I mean, in the recipes, I do put the measurements for the alternatives.
Okay.
And then something, it's not in the first cookbook because unfortunately I didn't think to do it until the book was almost finished. But the second book is actually going to have a QR code of me making the recipe. So every recipe will have a QR code and you just scan it, take you to my Instagram page, and you can watch a 30 second to a minute and a half video of me making the recipe. So I know a lot of people are very visual, so they might read it and be like, huh. But then they watch it and they're like, oh, it's not as, because I know a lot of times you'll look at a recipe and you're like, there's no way I can do this. That looks way too complicated. But then you watch somebody do it and you're like, oh, I got this. I totally can do that. Not a problem at all. So I think it also takes away the fear. So that's something that people can definitely check out as well.
That's really cool. I love that idea of being able to show what you're doing, the mixing, whatever the processes are, because that is what people, I think, are afraid of, is how to actually execute and how to mise en place, right? How to actually get things ready if they are, you know, some of these cuisines use a lot of spices, a lot.
Yes.
I was looking at some of the recipes and I was like, wow, that's a lot of ingredients. But if you start reading them, you're like, most of them you have in your house, there's a couple you probably have to go out and get, and you could cross-utilize, you know, it, depending on what it is. And again, spices last a long time. So
you'd
be able to use them over. So, okay. So book two is hopefully coming out sometimes 2026.
Yeah.
Are we sticking with two or how many are we going to go on the books?
No. So the plan was always to do three volumes. And so there'll be three. And then there's a possibility that I'll do volume four. But volume four, I was thinking would be all the recipe or all the countries from the first three books, but it would just be all breakfast items because we didn't do breakfast for any of them. We just did everything else. I'm sure whoever is going to be near my house for the months that I'm making that will get sick of breakfast food, but, you know, whatever.
There's no way. No way. No one gets sick of breakfast.
Months,
I can eat breakfast every night.
Breakfast food.
Oh, you cannot go wrong with breakfast food. Absolutely love it. How do people find your book? How do they find you on all the socials?
Absolutely. So everything is at Adina's Delicacies. The website is adinasdelicacies.com. You can find the book on Amazon or Ingram Spark, and you can search for Vegan Flavors of the World. It's volume one, a culinary exploration of plant-based recipes from every corner of the globe. And if you look for that or my name, Rachel Adina Mullen, Adina Mullen, Chef Mullen, it'll all pop up. And yeah, other than that, yeah, you can find me on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube.
Love it. Love it.
That handle.
Yeah, I'll put the links in the show notes as well, so it's easy for people to find if they want to pick that book up. Check out what you're doing. So stay tuned, everybody, because there is the part two coming. I'm going to go through the cookbook again. I just started looking at it today, and I'm like, ooh, a couple of those just look really tasty. So I've got to do some trial and maybe put up a video or two of trying them myself.
I can't wait to see what they look like.
Yeah, so I'll make sure I give you a tag on those. So be sure to check out that cookbook. Give them a try. If you're scared of plant-based cooking, don't be. It's not as scary as you think, for whether dietary reasons or you just want to change the lifestyle. It's really high quality stuff. So give it a try. Any last parting words before we go?
No, I just thank you so much for having me. And I really hope that people can use the book and really gather something important from it and, you know, get some new recipes from it.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Chef. And until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side.
Thank you.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.